You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 309.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. Here I have an episode for you, a Christmas Day episode, as it turns out, as the calendar allows. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays, everyone. Hope you enjoy. If you remember from last time, I recently finished the book, The Fourth Tourney is Here by Neil Howe, and I discussed it with Aaron last week on episode 308. In that episode, if you haven't had a chance to listen, we talked about the theory of the fourth turning and why it predicts continuing crisis in the 2020s. We gave an overview of the theory and talked about some of the cultural implications of generational theory, why different generations are different, why times change every generation, every 20 years or so, and what that has looked like in the past. Now we're going to get into the future. What does this theory say about what happens in the rest of the crisis, the rest of the fourth turning in the 2020s and early 2030s, and in the future down the line for, you know, several decades ahead? So let's bring it up. We have just gone into a cultural discussion of the fourth turning. Now we're going to talk about how will this crisis play out, because Neil Howe has given several different scenarios here. This is game time. If this truly is, look, there's an outside chance that we can get out of the fourth turning without a severe political crisis and violence, but it is unlikely.
And what would that even mean to get through the crisis without? I mean, I guess the answer is you'd have a minor crisis or a series of minor crises rather than a single severe crisis. But it seems like definitionally you've got to have something big and dramatic occur.
Things start to break. And like, what if they don't break, but they're still held up by a string? Then it seems like it just takes a little longer, right?
Well, right, it's not like if we keep slapping duct tape on it, that we don't get to pass into, you know, If we put enough duct tape on it, we don't get to pass to the high, without paying the penalty. Right. It just means that we're stretching out that generation, that period, until we get to the real break. And you've heard that sometimes in economic discussion, that the longer you put off a recession by, you know, whether it's manipulating interest rates or other maneuvers, it just means that you're going to have a bigger fall when it hits, and you can't outrun it forever.
Right. And so a fourth turning it's not a cultural upheaval, it's a political upheaval. And so institutions are going to be remade. Now, what are institutions? It's not necessarily political institutions, but it could be. It could be international agreements and relationships. It could be the way government works. It's not like, you know, the Constitution was created several fourth turnings ago, the U.S. government. And so fourth turnings have seen a reinvention of the U.S. government, but not necessarily an overturning of the whole.
We certainly have, there was a period where there was a lot of speculation about the EU completely collapsing. There was Brexit, and there was talk of other nations potentially wanting to exit the EU. And that would have dramatically reshaped the face of Europe and, by extension, the global economy.
I guess my point is, like, what are we putting duct tape on? Because, fourth turnings break a lot of things, but they don't break everything. And so that's kind of that's an interesting. There are things you could duct tape through a few different saculums, perhaps. And so it's interesting to see what clears the way. So we could get away with putting some things off for the future. And in fact, that's a big problem, because you go into a high, and if you want to overturn the consensus of society in a high politically, that's just very difficult to do. You've missed your window. You're going to have to wait. We probably don't have to wait till the next, well, you're probably not keen on waiting till the next generation, but you're basically going to have to figure out how to live with the the hand you were dealt. Because you can make changes in the high and the awakening, but it's just they're different. Okay, so but interestingly enough, like civil rights movement was an awakening movement, not a fourth turning movement. So there's that. Okay, so and if you look at the civil rights movement of the 60s and 70s, a lot of religious themes. You know, so it wasn't just a pure political movement. Okay, so but you know, there are political changes in the second movement, in the second turning, just like there are cultural changes in the fourth turning. And this is something that I have a hard time wrapping my head around with this, because it's like, okay, you know, we have big changes twice in the saeculum, which are going to fall. I feel like the type you can expect in the awakening is different than the type you can expect in the crisis, but there's some overlap there that I have not, that I'm not quite comfortable prognosticating yet, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Hopefully that makes sense. Let's talk about the first possibility, which is civil war, civil conflict. You know, we had one two turnings ago in the American Civil War. We had one three turnings ago in the Revolutionary War, which in many ways was also a civil war, because there were, you know, Tories on the American side fighting too.
Loyalists and separatists.
And interestingly enough, the next political conflict, which was resolved peacefully between the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist, which he also puts in the fourth turning, was also an internal conflict. And then three crises ago, three saeculum ago, there was a bunch of crazy stuff going on with the Puritans and the British, which I'm not qualified to speak on.
Now, are we looking back at English Civil War or further back than that?
Okay. No, this would be the Glorious Revolution of 1688, which also included a period where I believe it was the English crown tried to take direct control over the colonies, and there was kind of a mini revolt. It wasn't like American Revolutionary War, whereas we should be independent. It was like, no, we should have this political relationship with you and not that political relationship with you. There's also, when did Connecticut hide those kings that were...
Or the judges.
Oh yeah, the judges that were beheaded. I think that was also around the same time.
Yeah. That would make sense. And that's what eventually caused, was it New Haven to lose their charter?
Yeah, yeah. So I would currently be living in the state of New Haven if this didn't happen. Yes. So this is at the beginning of that fourth turning, where the king was actually beheaded in 1649. And so I guess that went all the way up to...
Is that one of the Charleses?
Yeah. I guess that went all the way up to like 1688. So that was like a 30-year crisis. The judges
involved. We are spoiled in our modern era. And maybe not if we consider the Iraq War II leading into... And Afghanistan and the Global War on Terror as all being part of the same thing. But... you know, a 30 years war, 100 years war, was not unusual. We've allowed ourselves to define what wars look like by
how
looking
long
at
was Afghanistan?
World War One, World War. Well, it was about 20 years, right?
Yeah, although not a war that we had to particularly worry about.
Well, yeah, it depends on who you are, but yes, it was. And in the same way, I haven't read much recently on some of those conflicts, but certainly the Hundred Years' War was not 100 years of constant conflict.
Right. Neither was 30 years.
It ebbed and flowed, but it didn't resolve itself, for decades. So I think we're perhaps spoiled by World War One and World War Two, which as ugly as they were, they had clear beginnings, clear endings, and those beginnings and endings were, you know, half a decade apart, roughly.
Right.
So it, perhaps, yeah, and I've heard it said that, in many ways the 20th century is an anomaly, and that we can expect some reversion to the mean of what history is typically like in the 21st century. I don't think that necessarily pairs up with what Strauss and Howe laid out, but maybe an interesting counterpoint there.
Yeah. So did you see the Civil War trailer that came out for 2024?
Yeah, that's been getting a lot of buzz in certain corners of the internet here in December.
Is it a warning? Is it just is it a possibility? What I find interesting about the trailer is that they're like Texas and California are on the same side, which people speculate is just they don't want to actually get into politics.
Right. Yeah. I've heard the theory that, well, perhaps that is to make it so that it is not purely a red tribe versus blue tribe, that can make some deeper commentary without getting caught up in that.
They've also, someone else also said, and again, I don't know if this is offensive or like the only possible way to get this to work. Well, yes, those are where the drug cartels ended up, which, you know, I could see that.
Well, there's certainly a significant portion of U.S. military equipment and personnel concentrated in those two states. Perhaps that's a piece of it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, the other possibility is an international war. And by the way, it's not either or. He makes that case. Could be both.
Well, and if we look back to the American Revolution, from as Americans, we view that as very much an American conflict. But that was just one piece in a global war that was going on at that point, largely between the French and the British. We were almost a back alley side brawl that was going on from their perspective.
It really does seem like the international order is breaking across the way. And we've had episodes about that. I mean, I'm going to link to the episode about the Ukraine war and about the Israel-Gaza war. You know, the first one, the Ukraine war, was episode 214. And the war in Gaza, I guess it was in Israel at the time we were talking about it, and now is in Gaza, is episode 300. So I am going to I'm going to put those in. So far, those wars seem contained to just their particular area, but they're all proxies for the major powers around it. And are we just going to have an expanded proxy war, or could this actually turn into a true great power war?
Yeah, well, I think it was I think I'd mentioned on previous episodes some of the writings from Peter Zahan. He's talked a lot about America potentially pulling back in their role of enforcing the global order, and how that is very much a linchpin for the stability of globalization. That you pull out one of those Jenga blocks, and all of a sudden there's a lot of I'm mixing my metaphors here, but there's a lot of domino effects that dramatically impact nations which you would not think of as necessarily being explicitly impacted by American action or inaction. I saw a news story just recently that was it Maersk, one of the large global international sea shipping companies, has decided not to bring their cargo through the Red Sea or Is the Red Sea the one that feeds into the Suez Canal? I think it is.
Yes. Yemen.
And the cited example was, I think the article said, despite the presence of two U.S. aircraft carriers in the region, which, of course, the counterargument is perhaps it is because of the presence of two U.S. aircraft carriers in the region. Previously, a lot of the talk of international order stability has been focused on piracy. But if you see more regional and international conflicts flaring up, that's going to have a dramatic impact there as well. So we might be seeing the first hints of that as we speak.
So we get a new global order. Now, these fourth turning wars, these get nasty. These are not just
Well,
they don't.
When you say new global order, it doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. will step back and China will step into their role. It's
much messier.
We could be moving from
even if that's the story, it's much messier than.
Well, it could be moving from a ostensibly unipolar world where the U.S. is the great hegemon. It may be moving to a bipolar world like we had during the Cold War. It could be tripolar. It could be, one or two big players, but then a band of smaller players that have a third influence. It could be any number of cases, and nobody that is not a clean, peaceful transition. It will be a very messy transition to figure out who sits in what seats at that table, whatever that, that future table looks like.
Yeah. And so what was the last table? That would be, was it like Yalta, or I get those confused, Yalta and Potsdam, or were those both?
There was Yalta, Potsdam, and there was one other, but yeah, where
the Marshall Plan,
the three allied leaders sat down and planned out not just how we were going to finish, off the Germans and the Japanese and end the war, but what the post-war world was going to look like, how it was going to be carved up ostensibly.
So there are moments in the fourth turning where basically the next 80 years are decided by like five people at a table in like 10 minutes. So it may be, maybe a little bit more than that, but that kind of thing is known to happen. I mean, maybe a little more than 10 minutes, and maybe a little more than five people have input, but that's probably not too far off.
Strauss-Howe generational theory is not necessarily incompatible with the idea of the great man theory of history, that there can be very, very influential, very important individuals who shape history within the template of this
right.
generational theory.
You can't be like, well, so and so came around and did this, and that prevented the nomad generation from appearing. Like that's not going to happen. So you can't stop the turnings. Like I was saying, these conflicts in the fourth turning, they're not. We're used to having conflicts that don't resolve. Before World War II, we had World War I, which resolved, but it didn't really resolve. There was no, I think that many of the political leaders after World War I thought that they were creating a new stable order, but they really weren't. They were just like, this is what feels good right now, and we're going to do it. We'd end the war, which is, what they needed to do, but unfortunately it was the wrong turning to put an end to the conflict once and for all. And so you needed World War II to get that way. By the way, World War II, most of the inventions, that we use today came out of World War II. And in fact, I'm going to go into another episode. I'm going to link to another episode, and this would be the Chris Wiggins on data science. Ah. Yes, because they wrote a book about the history of data science. Turns out that most of the important changes occurred during World War II. Those wars were like total, and it completely upends the order, just like, the Civil War completely overturns the system of slavery in the South, even if it ended up in a place where you didn't quite get the society you would want in the South, but by the end of Reconstruction, it really did overturn the agrarian society, the agrarian slave society that had.
Well, yeah,
had before.
Disruption does not always yield the desired results, but it does. It absolutely leads to change.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay, so what does that mean for the future? I mean, there is an outside chance we escape this. Either this whole theory is BS, number one, or number two, the other chance we escape this is that we're able to somehow, because of the technological state we're in, or because of the, because of a few, the decisions of a few people, we could somehow make these changes without mass violence. But it does not look good.
I'm going to jump the gun and mention something that you could go ahead. Dropped a hint about it already, but let's assume for the moment that this theory is solid and proven out. There are things that could break the theory going forward. Not that it's BS, but that there could be such a dramatic paradigm shift that it no longer applies. And so I'm thinking that, you know, if we see something that actually looks like the AI singularity that some forecasters have talked about in the past, that could negate a lot of this going forward.
Okay, but that's not slated to happen during the fourth turning.
No, I wouldn't expect it. We could be surprised, but yeah, I certainly wouldn't count on it.
Or it would come out at the fourth turning. It would be the resolution of the fourth turning. But in which case, it doesn't break the generational codes right away. But how would that break the generational codes? It would still be the case that you would grow up in a world that was with a worldview influenced by, you know, the previous generations.
I think the way that this could well and truly get broken is if we're looking at advances in longevity bordering on immortality, where all of a sudden the human lifespan is no longer bounded by that 80 to 100 year window, and maybe the generational theory would take on a new context with much longer timelines. If we're not seeing that regular pattern occur anymore, then you can't reasonably apply the same theories to that environment.
Right.
So
if we have a breakthrough
and we double the human lifespan by 2030, then that would throw a lot of things out of whack here.
Right. I think you would still see changes and shifts over time. As you said, it's hard to predict how that would change, but he does address the facts, not necessarily changing lifespans, but maybe this goes into to changing lifespans, like generations are staying relevant much longer. Interestingly, there's always like a generation that had lived through the previous crisis and they were children.
You mentioned these as was it the elder?
Yeah, the late elders.
Late elders. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's like the silent generation today. Some are still around. And the point he was making, at least this was true for World War II, is that there were still Civil War vets around during World War II. Civil War vets, but there are also people who were children during the Civil War. Okay. And they were very nervous because they were children during the Civil War. They saw that thing as like adults handled that. And now they're elders, late elders, and they see this new conflict coming around and they're like, oh, I don't know if we're up for doing what we did back then. Now, he also pointed out there were a few guys still alive who fought in the Civil War, and they were like 105, and and people were going to them for advice or prognostication. Well, you did it then. What do you think is going to happen now? And they're like, oh, we're not going to have a problem with this. We're going to, you know, we're going to whip them back to, you know, using a, using some derogatory terms for the Japanese, we're going to wipe them clean,
I wonder how much of that is survivorship bias is maybe the wrong term, but victor bias that,
I'm not saying that. It was true that America won the war, but I think I'm not saying that the previous hero generation was right and the previous silent generation is always wrong. It's just they looked at the new conflict very differently.
Yeah, I'm thinking that maybe we have very shrinking number of people who fought in World War II who are still alive today.
Right.
Plenty
of people who are alive.
Sure. Let's place ourselves in Germany for a moment. Let's stipulate that hypotheticals here that Russia has a major breakthrough in Ukraine and Ukraine topples and falls to an ascendant Russia. And all of a sudden, things are looking a little bit sketchier in Europe. NATO is a little bit more concerned. I wonder what the viewpoint of the Germans still alive who fought in and lost World War II would be in the context of what the future holds with the Russian bear at their door. That's a curious alternate history, alternate future scenario.
I don't know
that those people would be very willing to go on the record and talk about that, but
how they must have reinterpreted in their military service for the Nazis to live their long life. It's a very interesting question, actually. I guess you could start by looking at the Silent Generation at the time, but they're going to be a very different, they're going to have a very different opinion. Yeah. I don't know. I'd like to know. I don't know. What do you think their position would be? It wouldn't be, because they lost last time, so they might think, well, I'll probably lose this time.
Yeah, well, and not only did they lose, but depending on where they ended up on the east side or the west side of Germany, their experience under what I guess was at that point Soviet dominion, I would expect would dramatically shape their now and maybe that would make them a little bit black-pilled in the sense of this is going to go very poorly for us because we've been there, we've lived through that, or perhaps it might give them an incentive that it went really badly last time, so we need to absolutely make sure it doesn't happen again. But again, I'm wildly speculating at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one fourth turning political development that that Howe goes into that is not about mass violence and was resolved peacefully was the Constitutional Convention. And so that is a possible blueprint out of this, although the Constitutional Convention took place after the Revolutionary War, so there was a lot of violence during that turning. It was just part of it, the last part of it where it ended up at the resolution was not. But still, it might be a good example of, hey, not everything is like guns and deaths and stuff like that. So he places the Constitutional Convention as the ultimate resolution of the fourth turning of the Revolutionary War. I might have thought of it as kind of a first turning event, but he knows what he's doing, I assume. He interprets it at the end of the fourth turning. I'll post a link to what we've said about the Constitutional Convention, but that's another case where, it wasn't five people and 10 minutes, but it was still I don't know how many people were there. We're like 30 people over a summer trying to figure out how the U.S. is going to work for the next several hundred years.
Right. And you could certainly couch that as this was a moment where the fledgling nation was poised to tear itself apart over some of these key questions, key disagreements about what form it should take. And it was only when they came out of that with the Constitution that the crisis had been averted and they were able to move into the next period of stability, which the period of good feelings as he's labeled it.
Yeah. Which again, a little bit misnamed because in our history books that comes, that's only the tail end of it after the War of 1812. The Articles of Confederation, then the pre-Constitution times would have been considered fourth turning times, which from what I read, they were kind of disastrous. So maybe they were fourth turning times. And so the fourth turning war occurred early, but the political resolution occurred a bit later, which is kind of interesting.
Which is a good reminder that, winning the war is one thing, but winning the peace or achieving the peace after the war is much more complicated. We've seen that in our last couple of decades in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, Southwest Asia.
It applies second and third turning wars. So.
Domestically as well, in that it's not enough to win on the battlefield. You then have to find a way to transition into the next phase there.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do we have to look forward to? The first and second turning, right? So interestingly enough, Neil Howe places the Salem witch trials, the witch burnings, McCarthyism, and the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were, a bunch of censorship put forth by the Federalist Party in the U.S. After the Constitution went into effect, as kind of early first turning moral panics. So I always thought the witch burning was during the fourth turning. Really, it was, he places it in the first turning. Again, it's easy to quibble where it is, but it's either late fourth turning or early first turning. And actually, all of these things are kind of early. If he's indeed right, it's first turning, it's early first turning. So you have these kind of moral panics during the high where you continue to have mass censorship, which we've had now, although with Elon Musk buying Twitter, and now the other day with Alex Jones coming back on, it seems like a lot of the censorship overturned.
Did I hear that Kanye bought Parler or something?
Oh, that was probably a while ago. That's not as relevant.
Okay.
Now. But, you know, first turning can have its own brand of political authoritarianism, and I kind of wonder, I think it's hard to know how that would play out until the resolution kind of plays out. But what ends up happening in the first turning is, so the first turning might take a while to get to, because he points out the difference of the generations. A lot of people assume that the boomers are just going to go off to retirement community and have fun because they're getting old. That's what old people do, right? No, that's what old silent generation people do. The boomers don't want to do that. They want to stick around and stay involved and make sure that their moral crusade has come through. So they're not going to let go. Those retirement communities that became so popular over the last couple generations in Arizona and Florida, he predicts are not going to be as popular with the boomer generation. So they're going to stick around for a while. What was that? Right. So this, it might take a while before the boomers are not relevant. They will be relevant for the foreseeable future. You can't, and particularly since people are living much longer. Yeah. It's going to take a lot longer to get like into the meat of the first turning than you might like, but I guess the point is the point I was working towards here, which I got is that, once the nomad generation kind of enters elderhood, and then the silent generation enters young adulthood, or the artist generation, I guess the homelanders, you get a much more moderate society. People are not interested in adopting, slogans and stuff that are just there to like get a rise out of people, which seems like half the stuff you see on Twitter. And I don't think, you might have a similar movement to Black Lives Matter. I don't think that the slogan of the first turning for that same movement perhaps would be Black Lives Matter. They would try to choose something that's a little bit more unifying.
Well, your comment about the boomers and how they're not shuffling off anytime soon reminded me of, I'm not an economist, but I've heard it suggested that the passing of the boomers is going to be the greatest transfer of wealth that our nation has ever seen, in that the boomer generation has accumulated lots of resources. And perhaps this is part of why the millennial generation and the homelander generation feel that they're unable to get ahead in the world, that they don't have the ability to accumulate in the same way that the boomers have. But the boomers can't take it with them. And so when they do pass on, those resources are going to, come back onto the market essentially and be freed up. Whether that gets transferred to their children or pushed out into the open market, it's going to have a significant impact on both hard and soft assets. And that could be a triggering of a crisis in its own right.
Yeah. I feel like at this rate, that's not going to start happening for another like 20 years. but maybe.
Well, yeah, because I think we're probably past the peak point where boomers retiring, that more of them are probably out of the workforce than in it now, but they've set themselves up for a comfortable from their perspective, hopefully long retirement.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you're retirement, they're drawing down wealth, so that's opportunities for others. All right. And then, of course, after that, when we're the elders, it'll be the second turning, and our whole cultural world will be overturned. Kind of looking forward to that. But, you know, don't hold on, you know, don't hold your breath, because it's going to be a while. But Hal predicts that millennials and homelanders will wonder why their kids aren't as close to them as they are to their parents culturally, because we'd be in an awakening. Okay, he didn't talk that much about AI and cryptocurrency, which and general AI, or the like you said, the singularity and all that. I think that's a very important part of the story. What he does mention is, you know, technology fits the time. So, for example, in the 1920s, the automobile is seen as an expression of individualism, individual freedom. In the 1950s, the automobile is a symbol of conformity. Likewise, I think the internet in the 1990s was seen as a symbol of individual freedom in the
1980s. It was the digital Wild West.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a symbol of liberation. Today, in the 2020s, in the fourth turning, it's kind of become the symbol of oppression.
It's whether you call it Web 2.0 or 3.0, but yeah. You know, it's become a corporate garden a corporate playground, and not the realm of eccentric individuals.
Right. And so that will remain into the first turning, but perhaps it'll be more a symbol of conformity. It won't be like everyone shouting at each other, you know, mainly because probably they've sanitized it further, which I don't know. I feel about that, but that's, but at least it won't be used for kind of the kind of radical bomb throwing that it is today, which again, if you feel that society needs radical bomb throwing, that's not good for you either, but you know.
Well, and I think that fits in with what you were talking about before, with you know, the witch burnings, McCarthyism. That the first turning could very well have with it a authoritarian streak or authoritarian yeah. element.
Interestingly, though,
and
I should point out
that may be you know, in a form of some sort of digital censorship or digital control.
Yeah. I should point out all of those examples were somewhat temporary. All of those examples lasted for 2 years at most, until things reverted back to the mean. So it's kind of like the first turning doesn't, well, I mean, I guess the witch burning kind of went overboard. And, but, you know, it didn't, if you started with the witch burning, you said, wow, this is really bad. You predicted 5 years we'd be in like a authoritarian kind of, Orwellian society of witch burners. That's not what happened. It kind of like burned itself out, so to speak.
It flamed out.
Yeah. Same with the McCarthyism. Same with the Alien and Sedition Act. They lost the election, you know. So, so it at least there's that. But different kinds of things will be censored on the internet than are censored today, and different kinds of things will be promoted on the internet than they are today. There could almost be like an inversion.
And certainly, you know, if you'd asked us 10 years ago or absolutely 20 years ago, you know, what kind of things would be censored on the internet today, I don't think we would have been able to make very, very accurate guesses.
True.
I mean, there's probably some stuff that, you know, if we're talking about, you know, certain, you know, child pornography and stuff, well, that's a gimme. That was already, you know, stuff that was certainly being tried to eliminate back then. But the stuff that is getting people wound up today is, I don't think we would have been able to predict that very, very easily,
right,
10, 20 years ago. So what are we missing looking at another 10 or 20 years ahead of us here?
Right. I mean, I want to kind of come to a prediction with this, because, it almost seems like there'll be like guardrails on on tone and like the proper way to have a conversation online.
So you don't think that's an aspect that's going to flame out? That may be something that's with us to stay.
So if there's kind of a moral panic around it, similar to the ones in the past, they'll go overboard for a couple of years, and then they'll.
I don't know how much this applies to the world at large or kind of even the internet at large, but it certainly seems like there's been a moral panic about biases in AI or specifically in LLMs, which is literally, involved them putting up, literally metaphorically, actually putting up metaphorical guardrails on things that the LLM can and can't do, can and can't say. Do we think that that's a long-term approach, or is that a very temporary phase here? And we're going to come out the other side and there'll be kind of a break on the hold of who can, train and control LLMs and set those weights and train those guardrails into it. And it'll become impossible to control that. Yeah. Or is that going to be a baked in feature of, these large language models for decades to come?
Well, if we go by this theory, we're not going back to the 90s. That's for sure. Hmm. So, I think for the time being, you've got some control, but it's hard to imagine what the story is going to actually be on that one. So I don't know if there's anything else I could say about this other than, I think we should do some more shows on AI and crypto and talk about the fourth turning as we have in the past, because I think that, that's what we're really good at here in the Local Maximum. So
some more shows. And I'm thinking, the easy question to ask is, so what should I do to better prepare to survive the crisis and make my way into the high?
Is this all useless information? I hope not. I don't think it is.
Well, and I don't have a good answer to that. But yeah. the other question that I'm thinking of as a father, what do I have to be doing to best mold my children, who I assume are members of that homeland generation, so that they can effectively meet the challenges when their generation is ascendant.
I think.
How do we fulfill our mentor role, not just our leadership role?
So you can't go against the grain and of the generations. But I think one of the things that's really helpful about studying this stuff is that it kind of gets you out of your generational mindset. So, for example, silent generation folks and more generally artist generations, that the homelanders are, they tend to, and we'll see if it plays out, but whereas Gen Xers like to start new companies and consult in individual basis, artist generations tend to like to join larger organizations and just kind of be, kind of work in groups like that. And so, I guess there's just sort of a realization that you might think this is the right way to do it because this is how I grew up, but the next few generations are going to be very different. And the relationship between the next generation and you is not an interpolation of the relationship between you and your parents, a generation. Right. And so
it's a reaction to it, if anything.
Right, but it's not the same direction. You might think, my parents are like this and I'm like that, so the next generation is going to be like that squared. Not exactly, it's a circle, see? So
you can't square the circle.
It's going to be a little interesting. And also I think we grew up in a time that was very individualistic, and I still strongly believe in in individual freedom, individual liberties and all that, but you have to realize that and you could have that at any turning in any social attitudes, but you also have to be more open to the fact that people want to, that different at different times, the groups of people alive at that time are going to want to use these freedoms a different way, whether it's to, you know, join, go it alone, or join large organizations, or, you know, whether you want to kind of fight the prevailing attitudes, or conform to them.
Yeah, that we can look forward to in our old age seeing a unstoppable wave towards more centralization and more kind of collectivism, or is that overreading the tea leaves here?
Well, that's going to fall apart at the second turning. So, in for the foreseeable future, yes, but it doesn't necessarily have to be economic. So it doesn't mean it's going to be kind of like socialism in the sense that the government is going to take over, but it might be the sense of, well, like the return of the you know, career in a large organization or something like that. I think that free markets can survive a first turning, can survive the saeculum. I don't know if communism or fascism, for that matter, could survive the saeculum, because it always seems to fall apart during an awakening when people want more kind of individual choices, which, you know, under a free society, you could have that. You could have more choices. You could have less choices. Let the people decide. Under a communist society, for example, you have to really change the system in order to do that. And that could either be, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union, as with Russia, or it could be like, you know, the reforms in China with Deng Xiaoping, which occurred in the second and third turning in China. Now China's become more dictatorial, but that's, you know, that's because we're in the wrong turning for that. So that's kind of my theory that I'm working on in my head, where those economic systems don't last the saeculum.
Interesting.
Any reaction to that, Aaron, before we do that?
Yeah, so I guess I had something and it escaped me here. I'm drawing a blank right now.
All right. Well, we'll head out. Any more questions for me before we head out for the day? I know we've done two shows so far, so.
Oh, I'm really trying to pull up what was at the tip of my tongue before.
Do you remember what it had to do with?
Yeah, it had to do with what we were talking about with the kind of millennials and homelanders, and parents. I know where I was going with this. Okay. So what if anything does Howe have to say about kind of the multi-generational family? I've certainly been an example of, you know, I leave home, I move away. It's not that I never see my parents, but my parents are not a day-to-day influence on my children. And so they're not getting that direct knowledge transfer. And I think that's pretty common for, at least here in America, people are, because of the way we've migrated internally, it's rare to have a household or a community where you have those three generations or even four generations under the same roof, which maybe 50 years ago was significantly more likely to occur. Is that something that he potentially sees pendulum swinging back, or is that a one-way ratchet?
Yeah. Actually, I don't know what he says about today. I think he claims it's already been swinging back.
He's talked in the past, because it would have been well after the first book. But yeah, I think we discussed perhaps the idea of, oh, you know, millennials or some of the what he's now referring to as the homelander generation, you know, having to move back in with their parents after college, and the effect that's had.
I think he does point to the fact, again, with the boomers, is that they are, in relation to the people who came before them, they are more likely to want to hang out with people not their own age. So boomers might be a part of this return to a multi-generational family. Now, that might be not be true in every case, but I don't know what the full data says, but that's what Howe has said in the book. So
that was interesting. A big part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I don't know. I think a lot of people are feeling the pull of kind of family life where it's like, you kind of, you go out in the world and you work and you sort of realize that, a lot of these connections are just, are not as strong. There's a lot of problems that come up.
Well, yeah, you already mentioned possibly a
the fourth turning, you realize you can't rely on people. Yeah.
And that may take the form in,
well, not just a career, but like a staying at a company or a big organization.
That's exactly what I interpreted.
Or maybe it's just a system.
As saying, but part of that may also be we've taken a very kind of a mercenary approach in the last couple of decades with, you know, it's much more acceptable for people to hop from company to company. There's no loyalty there, so the that leads to a very, you know, career first or job first approach to how you're living your life, because you're chasing, you know, the bigger, better opportunity all the time, and that perhaps a move back into a more traditional, long serving career with a you know, stable with a single company, may lead to the ability to have less of a focus on work and career to the exclusion of other things, to a stronger, kind of family life balance. Now maybe that's just wishful thinking, but no. I can kind of picture that.
I could picture that as a backlash as well. And then of course you could picture the backlash to the backlash a few generations hence, where they're like, this is really restricting.
Well, there could absolutely be an aspect of that involves, you know, fewer two income households, where one parent decides to stay home and raise the children, or be more involved in that aspect of that, and that may or may not have pendulum swings in terms of you know, conservative values versus more progressive ones. But there's certainly ways you could go in that direction without it being all about, you know, gender roles and traditional conservatism.
Yeah, although gender roles do make a comeback at the end of the fourth turning. So that's this, well, I, according to how, look, I don't know if any of this will happen, but that's
there's certainly in the zeitgeist. Now what making a comeback means ostensibly is
it's going to be very different than it does
debate, yeah. But
it's going to be very different than what it meant in 1946.
It's very much a topic of tension.
Yeah. That is for sure. But maybe it would just be, you know, stronger family roles, you know, where we're just like, you know, people are more focused, because we don't, growing up, we never heard like, here's how a good family works. We basically heard the message of, yeah, you know, it just, whatever works, just do it, you know? and there was just no, we were not provided with any guide. And I think the reason we were not provided with any guide is because the previous generations thought that the guides they were given were kind of too restricting and too kind of like sexist maybe, or too like, you know, to one size fits all. So they're like, okay, we're not even going to try. And maybe that's caused problems that need to be revisited.
It raises some interesting questions. Not okay. Ones that we're going to solve tonight though.
Well, so we'll stop it there. Because there's a lot to think about. And, I think our audience is going to, come at us with some interesting, points and questions that we can answer later. localmaxradio@gmail.com or join our locals maximum .locals.com if you want to weigh in. Aaron, thanks for coming on today. Think you want to do a year-end show for the new year?
Yeah, we'll have to figure out what to focus that on, but let's plan to do that.
All right, awesome. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.